The broadcast is now starting. All attendees are in listen-only mode.
A warm welcome to all of you on the line for this Q&A with David Barr. David is the president and CEO of Pender Fund Capital Management. He's also the portfolio manager of the award-winning Pender Value Fund and Pender Small Cap Opportunities Fund. I've had the pleasure of meeting David in Zurich for the Zurich project. He has also contributed his ideas and insights at our online conferences. And so it's a real pleasure to get David's perspective in this turbulent time. David, I will turn it to you to kind of set the stage for us, and then we will take it from there. Please go ahead.
Thanks, John. Thanks, everyone, for listening in today. You know, it's busy out there. You know, when John asked me to speak, very much wanted to talk about, you know, the current environment and asked me to talk about what we're doing in this environment. And when you look at, you know, the way we look at things today, my partner Felix and I wrote a piece a couple of years ago about what to do in a market downturn. And the first thing we say is, you know, the best thing to do sometimes is nothing. And because a lot of times when events like this happen, you know, it's, as we know, markets are driven by fear and greed, and fear becomes an overwhelming emotion, and it really impairs your investment making decision in periods of time like this. So, you know, usually we say do nothing. That is not this time. You know, what we're seeing today, you know, we're seeing pieces of various puzzles that we've looked at and lived through over time. We look back at the financial crisis 2008, 2009, which was, you know, very much a debt crisis. And coming out of that, you know, the government bodies built the playbook. And, you know, today we can kind of see that they're rolling out that playbook. And as we've come to from the announcements over the past little bit, they're expanding on that playbook. So that's, you know, one aspect of what's going on. You know, the more challenging part today is, you know, first and foremost, I mean, we're facing the largest healthcare crisis or probably in anyone's generation here today. And, you know, it's tough to talk about because it can impact all of us on a very personal level. But as investors, we kind of have to step back and look at how, you know, the world is currently changing and will change moving forward. And I think, you know, that what we're certainly seeing right now is a massive drop off in demand. And, you know, I think what, you know, our team, you know, Felix, myself, Jeff, we were all, you know, fairly tied to investing in the technology sector in the early 2000s. And that was another period of time where demand, you know, probably didn't fall off as much as it may here. The end result, maybe it fell off more than it does as we work through what's going on today. So for us, doing nothing is not really an option. And what we need to do is, or what we've been doing is focusing on our trinity of risk. Number one is balance sheet risk. And this ties into the credit comment I made. We're having a credit market event, and the reality is there are companies that, you know, probably wouldn't get financed if they have short-term maturities right now, and may not get financed a little further out if they're weakened and can't raise capital. So first thing we've done in this is gone through our portfolio and reevaluated every single company for balance sheet risk. You know, fortunately, it's something we try to avoid, but in more of the special sit side of what we do where we have shorter duration ideas, we will take on a bit more balance sheet risk, but we've gone through and tried to mitigate that as much as possible within the portfolios. The second and more challenging part is evaluating business risk. You know, the third part of the trinity risk, valuation risk, that's easy right now. I mean, there's a whole bunch of out of the money call options on businesses moving forward here. Business risk is real in this environment. And, you know, that really takes me back to early days in my career where, in the venture capital world, you're invested in companies that may be pre-revenue, or you've invested in early stages of revenue, and then all of a sudden all your customers are going bankrupt or not spending any money because they're all worried about not being able to survive. And that's the type of environment we're in today. So what we've done is we've stepped back and we've asked ourselves, two questions: what's not going to change and what will change? And it's interesting, the what will change question is it's a very exciting question to answer, because people are going to ask themselves, who are the winners coming out of this? One of the positions in our portfolio, JD.com, that was a physical retailer in China during SARS in 2003. And Richard Liu, founder, CEO, anyone who's followed us a little bit knows how much we respect founders and their ability to assess risks as well as build their business. He saw a massive shutdown and realized that he had to sell online goods in order to support his stores because nobody was going to come into his stores. And now, he's one of the largest online retailers in China, and, did a wonderful job building out his logistics network, and is probably, the best source of goods in China right now for online delivery. And so you always have to, when in periods like this, there's always going to be people trying to pick who the next winners are going to be. And, certainly, we spend a lot of time in the tech space and healthcare and consumer products. So there's a lot to do on that side. But I think just as importantly, it's what's not going to change. And I mean, everybody can talk about one of the largest companies in the world, Amazon, and Jeff Bezos. And his basic premise was, what will not change? And it's, customers are going to want goods cheaper and faster. And so when we're looking at our portfolio, really retesting our thesis and saying, the reality is the facts have changed in pretty much every company today. Reformulating the thesis and saying, how does this fit into the world as we know it today?
Thank you so much for that overview. In the article that you referenced, when you say do something, in other words, don't just sit there, you cite four categories of things that can be done. Could you please go into those a little bit?
Yeah, in periods like this, where we gravitate to is switching our ideas so that we can high grade our portfolio into compounders. And what are compounders to us? It's the higher quality businesses with the really long run rate. And in periods like this, they get to valuations that are actually quite attractive. The second aspect would be looking at more close the discount companies, and that's companies that are an average business, a slower growth rate, but still good market positioning. And in markets like this, some of these companies can just get so wildly mispriced, they can be pretty attractive. The third thing is moving into blue chips, and blue chips can be a wonderful place to be right now because they're inherently market leaders. They should have better balance sheets to withstand downturns, and if they're well run, they can actually take advantage of situations like this to dig their moat deeper and take out weaker competitors, and just build a much better business franchise. The fourth thing you can do is go to cash. I think you're probably seeing a lot of people doing that in the market today, which, generally when everyone's buying something, that probably means it's expensive. And, we certainly think that it's good to have a bit of cash on hand right now. But with the opportunities out there, it's not an attractive time to be building up cash positions too high. The key point today is in this business environment, and what we're doing is we're really focusing on the compounder side of the equation, and it's not just for it's not just for today or the portfolio for a year out or 2 years out. I remember Felix and I sitting down in 2009, and you know, it was probably in March of 2009, and we were not having the best of days, and we said, but then we started just talking about the businesses that we knew, and said, wow, like, you know, he told me this company was really cheap, and I told him about a company that I thought was super cheap, and we kept on trying to one up each other, and so it came down to a bet, and we both had a stock pick, you know, who's going to pick the better name, and which company will do better, and I mean, I thought this was going to be easy because I'm looking at small and micro cap stocks, and there was this one micro cap I knew incredibly well. I was really high conviction. Private market value would have been about $1.50 on this company, and it was trading at 50 cents on the 50 cents. So, you know, I think I already had this game won before we even started. And so I picked that company, and then Felix looks at me and says, Starbucks. And the joke is I don't really like Starbucks coffee, so I thought it was a bad call just from that. That's another lesson we can all learn is just because you don't like a product doesn't mean a whole bunch of other people won't. But Starbucks was $7 then. And, you know, you fast forward to today, I mean, I'm not sure where it is post, there were splits in there and whatnot. So, I mean, it's greater than a 10X. So in periods like we have right now, this is when you can buy those compounding companies where valuations are actually quite attractive and build wonderful long-term returns into your portfolio. Of course, the hard part is not selling them in 5 years or 3 years or 6 years. But maybe, John, I'll come join you online and we'll talk about how not to sell your flowers when we're there.
Great. Well, Dave, I'd like to get a little bit more specific, if we can, in terms of where you're looking for those compounders. Are they companies you've known for a long time? Are they new things you're looking at? And are there any specific sectors that these companies are emerging from?
Yeah, we historically had a fairly high tech weighting, particularly in the small cap fund, about 50%. And in the last couple of years, a lot of companies have been acquired. Valuations have got a little bit, you know, ahead of where we would like to be owning these companies. So we took our weighting down in tech quite a bit. But, you know, we still follow the space, and there's a lot of companies in that space that we like quite a bit. And, you know, I think when we talk about idea generation, our favorite idea is a recycled idea where it's a business we know incredibly well. And, you know, we may have exited on valuation, or maybe risks or thesis had changed, but then we get an opportunity like this to reevaluate our thesis and see if it's a good time to reenter it. So we're spending a lot of time in the technology space. You know, I think when you look at where we're at today, technology companies are very cap light. They tend to have very strong balance sheets. Those are the types of businesses where if this is extended, I think you want to have your capital deployed. And technology always captures the new opportunities coming out of periods of time like this. I mean, we've already seen Zoom stock. I mean, what a great opportunity, like lot of user adoption on Zoom now. But there's a bunch of second order effects like network infrastructure. We instituted work from home a week ago, and our first conference call, people were having a hard time getting in, mostly because circuits were overloaded. So, work from home, it's putting larger demands on networks. So there's going to be, the providers are going to have to increase their network speeds. There's companies out there which optimize networks for this sort of thing. So there's lots of interesting things in the technology space. And this ties back to my comment about how are things going to change. And, we've spent a lot of time talking about, business travel, people's workflow. We've a lot of tech companies already do a tremendous amount of work from home and have remote teams. And I think this is something that will, you know, other human capital based businesses will awaken them to the fact that this is a real possibility. And, you know, you tie that into, I think, with a health scare of this nature, there's probably people who are going to be less interested in living in larger dense urban centers. So you might get people moving to, you know, Midwest United States. I'm in Canada, so moving to the interior of British Columbia or Vancouver Island. And all these things, you know, will tie into the work from home opportunity. And there's a whole bunch of secondary and tertiary effects that come out of that. Other areas we're obviously looking are on the healthcare side. I think having been confronted with what we are today is just going to heighten everyone's concern about things that could happen in the future. I mean, we still have a long way to go on this one. And, you know, I feel pretty optimistic. I mean, here, the entire global healthcare organization, a very large percentage of them are focused on finding a vaccine, but also a treatment for COVID-19. And I don't think we've ever had a period of time where we have the resources available and the level of intellectual horsepower driven to solve two problems, being A, prevention, and then B, a treatment. So, you know, it's gonna have a big impact on healthcare and biotech moving forward. You know, it's like, if you kind of think back to, you know, World War II and, you know, defense industries and the mass buildup of manufacturing, and a lot of technology companies came out of that. There's going to be a whole bunch of secondary discoveries that come out of this this mass rotation to finding solutions here. And who knows where the opportunities may present themselves there.
To what extent are you looking at compounders in the hardest hit sectors like travel and such that may be tech-based but have really gotten hit because demand has evaporated? I'm thinking of a company like Booking or similar types of companies that undoubtedly are very high-quality companies but in the near term are going to suffer.
Yeah, it's... I think we've probably talked about the fact that we were a large investor, had a large position in TripAdvisor a while ago, and we fortunately had exited that position based on that everything's going on. And I mean, we look at the travel space right now, and it's on our too hard pile. There's so many factors that will go into it. It's how fast the potential or recovery will be. And then you've got both business travel and pleasure travel. I could see a lot of business travel slowing down as a result of this, when people realize that it's as easy to do things online. And I mean, as we are right now, I mean, we're having a wonderful conversation and talking to a lot of people who we've met at Zurich Project and other places over the years. And on the pleasure side, there's going to be a tightening in consumer spending habits. Where does travel fall on the needs for consumers? I imagine it's going to be pretty low. And then, you know, does travel get a little bit harder? I mean, are borders going to be more strictly enforced? So it's a pretty challenging space to be right now. I think, you know, the beneficiary will probably be local travel, which for some countries will be a big benefit.
Dave, I'd love to talk a little bit more about the small cap space, a space you look at extensively. Small caps were very cheap going into this. What's happening there right now, and are you fishing in that pond?
Yeah, well, they've got cheaper. It's really interesting right now. I mean, at the beginning of March, we pushed out just a chart from one of our letters. You know, we had six companies that we kind of, you didn't have to go through the portfolio to find too hard, that double-digit free cash flow yields, double-digit earnings growth rates. But the world, just investors were not gravitating towards small cap at all. And I think, structurally, a lot of the move towards passive investing in ETFs has taken out a lot of the active management who would traditionally, either dabble or focus on small and small cap companies. So, that space has been vacated for a while, and I've been pounding the table on how great the opportunity was in small cap stock. And now I think we've seen Russell Microcap Index. I mean, if the system changed 10% per hour, apparently, but I mean, we're down like 40% year to date on the Russell Microcap. So the things that the ETFs don't own right now are massively out of favor. And, what we're seeing right now is opportunities, there's where companies are trading below the cash they have on their balance sheet. They are selling into essential services or infrastructure builds that we think are going to go on. And the market value is less than the cash they have on the balance sheet, and they have no debt. And, we see opportunities like this right across the board now, particularly in Canada. So it's a great time to be, we're basically buying all these businesses for free. But it's, there's not a lot of interest in that space right now, which is always there's never interest when things are this cheap. So it's a good time for us to be there.
Do you want to highlight, one or two companies, or should we move on to other topics?
We're very active on the blotter right now, so unfortunately, compliance won't let me talk about an individual name. My apologies.
Got it. Dave, I'm just also wondering how you think about portfolio management and risk management at a time like this in terms of how much cash to hold, how active to be in the portfolio, how to scrutinize the correlations, and so forth.
Yeah. So, historically, we would run up to 5 to 6% max weightings for high conviction compounders, and That was driven twofold. When you have a narrower opportunity set of companies you find attractive, as well as a lower risk business environment, we think that's the prudent way to weight our sizing. In this environment, I mean, we're almost more of a venture capital type approach, where we're targeting max or position sizes of 2-3%. Because there's so many opportunities where we have that way exceed our internal IRR thresholds, but the business risk and climate out there is substantial, and so that's really where you want to limit your exposure to any one name, because if things do work out, it's going to work out great, but we know things are not going to work out, so let's mitigate the exposure for things that we think. Mitigate our exposure to names that may potentially not work out. So, the business environment's changing so quickly right now that, what we may think is going to work today may not be the case in a couple of weeks. So, you do have to be nimble in this environment. Cash is good because you don't know when these opportunities are going to come at you. I mean, we've seen things gapping down 25. One company in our portfolio gapped down, I think it was like 50-60% in one day. And, that was just fear driven. And as soon as the stock starts going, I don't know if it's algos or quants or whoever's piling on the trade, but there's an opportunity for us to increase our weighting something, you know, where we know the business incredibly well at a really good price. So it is definitely prudent to have cash. We're in our various funds, we're kind of high single digits to 20% right now on the equity side, really depending on how conservative the mandate is. It's also nice to lower the volatility of the portfolio a little bit in times like this. The correlations we get most concerned about are on the revenue side, because I think that's where, you know, that's where the majority of the risk is right now with this slowdown we're in the middle of, and it's probably going to accelerate. So it's understanding who the customers are and, you know, how long they're going to potentially continue to buy the product for, and, you know, is there diversity at that level? And then, you know, kind of second order is understanding supply chains. I mean, we talked to, you know, I was chatting with Don on our team and Felix, and I think we've probably spoken to over 70 CEOs in the past 2 weeks. And, you know, it's a lot of CEOs are, you know, they're not seeing that end demand slow down yet. But if you're a business to business company, so if you're selling something to another business, you know, that other business may not be, they're probably not telling you that they're not thinking of buying product at this point in time. So there's definitely some lag that comes into play there. You know, what's more interesting is asking the CFOs where they're planning on cutting costs, because that can give us a bit more revenue sensitivity on what companies see as mission critical and where they're going to continue to spend. So that can give us more conviction into businesses and the quality of the revenue that we're looking at. It'll also kind of let us know areas where CF companies may be cutting, so revenue is more at risk and potentially avoiding those areas.
I'd be curious what you're seeing in terms of deal activity or prospects for M&A activity in a market like this. Does it just fall off a cliff, or is there still some activity there?
I mean, I think everyone's probably still in the shock phase. I mean, this has happened pretty quickly and dramatically. I think, you know, it generally will probably take a little bit before the M&A market picks up. And what I always talk about on the M&A side is you need, you know, for M&A to happen, you need a willing buyer and a willing seller. And, you know, 3 months ago, we had a whole bunch of companies with big balance sheets growing, and we had a whole bunch of private equity firms with capital to deploy. And we had a bunch of companies trading at 52-week highs and maybe thinking it was a good price. So, you know, we went from kind of a euphoric type M&A environment to now what we're seeing is, you know, I think M&A is certainly probably not at the fore of anyone's thought process right now. It's survival. And what we'll probably see in the next 3 to 6 months is, as companies start to assess whether or not they can go on their own, they will look to sell themselves to someone stronger in the industry. And, you know, that's where, you know, you got our, you know, Mr. Buffett sitting there with $120 billion of cash. You know, he's going to be active at some point. You know, Brookfield sent out a letter today, and Brookfield Asset Management, you know, they're pretty well positioned to take advantage of opportunities in this market. And I think this is where you really, you know, you see the founder CEOs who understand risk and they've run their businesses conservatively. You know, I think this is where they're probably going to get more aggressive in terms of buying businesses. And the valuations are certainly there, and it makes sense to them. What we'll just be waiting on is for the willing sellers to emerge. And that's a function of, you know, how bad this gets and timing. And then, I mean, it's interesting. You see the CEOs who do this repeatedly. I think John Malone, Liberty, put in a big buyback at Liberty Latin, last week. I mean, I think everyone on this conversation has probably read the book Outsiders, and, you know, CEOs have great capital allocation techniques. I mean, there's not a lot of professional CEOs are backing up the buyback truck right now. But, you know, it's interesting to see those CEOs that are right now. I mean, I think that's a pretty good indicator of, you know, they feel pretty comfortable with the balance sheet of their business and their stock is really cheap.
Dave, maybe as we finish up, I'd be curious on the business side for you. How do you ensure that clients maintain the right mindset in this kind of environment and that they remain long-term oriented here?
Yeah, we have a wonderful client relationship team here at Pender. You know, the communication and providing our clients with the information they need, in particular about our process and what we're doing. I mean, I think we've always tried to focus on our process when we're out there talking to investors, because if they understand the process, then you know, they're in good times, they're likely to understand the process when these sorts of things, events happen in the market, because as we know, these types of events will happen in the market. So a lot of that groundwork is done ahead of time, and we're really fortunate. We have a lot of great investors who are, you know, value driven, long-term in nature, and understand that, you know, our entire investment team is sitting there reassessing all the risks of the portfolio and doing the best we can.
Great. Well, Dave, I will leave it there. Do you have any closing remarks?
No, John, thanks. Thanks for the conversation. I mean, I think what we've done, just I guess to end it off, what we've done is we've kind of looked out and said, you know, what does this look like out 18 months from now? And, you know, the river between here and 18 months from now may be a little violent right now, but the other side of that riverbank, it's looking pretty good. There's a lot of opportunities out there, and you know, if the worst thing people can do today is panic and deviate from their process, because if they don't, then the other side of the river, you're gonna be happy, things are gonna be good. But you know, just make sure you get there by sticking to your process.
Well, on that note, Dave, thank you so much for taking the time to be here with us and share your perspective. Always appreciate your insights.
Great. Thank you, John, and thank you, everybody.
Thank you very much. Goodbye for now.